Welcome to another edition of the All Souls Forum here on KKFI. Tonight's program talks about the American family and how it's changing. Our speaker is Deborah B. Smith, director of UMKC's Family Studies Program. She's going to talk about the history of the American family and offer two new definitions of family to help us understand how it's changing. We'll follow our usual format. This program generally divides in two. We will have, first of all, her talk for about 30 minutes or so. Then we'll have a short break. Then we'll have questions from the audience. The program was recorded on Sunday, October 11th of 2015 at the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church in Kansas City, Missouri. And we will go directly to the introduction of Ms. Smith.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the forum at All Souls. I'm Carolyn McDonald, a longtime member of the committee. Today, our topic is about changing American families, and Deborah Smith from UMKC is going to be speaking. She's director of the Family Studies Program there, chair of the Sociology Department, so we'll now hear from her. And I'll mention that at the very end of her talk, there's going to be a two-minute video. And so we'll wait until the video is done before we get ready for our questions and take our collection.
Good morning. Thank you all for having me here. I appreciate it. It's good to hear that story so I can sort of help contextualize some of the talks, the things that I wanted to talk about today. In addition to studying current families, I've done a lot of studying of historically families in the United States, and we are going to focus on families in the United States, and we'll be talking mostly about European American families and their history. Fortunately, we're getting a lot more understanding of being able to talk about families from other traditions in the United States, but that's sort of where we come from, this idea of what is the family or a family. And let's see, is it gonna go this way? Let's just, all right. So what is society's go-to image of the family? And when we think of it, usually when I start my class, I ask students, you know, what is a family? And so we try to go through it. I'm not gonna go through it a little bit today. The main thing to know is that it's sort of like, you know, I know it when I see it, but it's really difficult to define. And certainly as family scientists, as family sociologists, you have to be able to find it, to define it, to be able to study it. And one of the ways, if it's hard to define it, we could at least look to see sort of what families do. But our society's go-to image is this 1950s breadwinner, the term is breadwinner homemaker family, where you have a husband and a wife, heterosexual couple with kids, and the picket fence, and that was, you know, discussed in the little blurb for my talk about why is it so persistent. So next slide. You know, we know that it's not reality. We know that that's not how people live their lives anymore and how families exist, but why is it so persistent? So just click it and keep clicking, I think I have. All right, so the reason why it's so persistent is because it's easy, right? We are a very, very different kinds of families. Right, and so we don't have an easy way to say, well, what do families look like today? Well, there's all different types of families, and you just heard Carolyn talk about three different types of families. And so because it's not a soundbite, because it's not easy to talk about the family with a capital F, we just sort of kind of fall back on what we have experienced before or what, you know, our culture is sort of holding up as the ideal. So it's not reality, but it's persistent because it's easy to sort of grab onto. So if we can't define it, next question, next slide, let's talk about functions. What does the family do? And this is where we get into, again, the little blurb talked about two different definitions of the family. And because the family has really been two different aspects. There's an economic aspect to it, and then there's an emotional aspect to it. And we need to kind of look at both of them if we're going to really understand how can we help families do what they need to do, and also as policies, how do we need to think of families to make sure that our policies are helpful. So at the most fundamental level, what families do is they keep us alive, right? So, and then go ahead and click. We are social creatures. I saw that Julie Urbanik is going to talk again. She's awesome. She's talking next week. If we don't have an older human taking care of a baby human, that baby will die. All right. It's not like fish. It's not like frogs where they just, you know, have the eggs and they go away. Right. So at a very basic level, we have to have families just to kind of keep the society and our culture and species going. So there's that one particular thing, is taking care of young people and older people. So next slide. Historically, so I'm going to go back with American families in colonial America, families did what we call public services, right? If you think about the subsistence farm in colonial America, we were mostly rural area, and so there weren't a lot of city centers. So families in that sort of institution of the family farm did it all. They did education. They were the hospitals. You didn't just, you know, go down to St. Luke's, right? You had to sort of figure out it yourself. Houses of correction, orphanages. You would go maybe live with somebody else. Lots of step families in colonial America. We don't really think about that, but a lot of step families because women died in childbirth. And with this family type, where you had to be in a farm and everybody had their role, husband, you know, men and women, and everybody worked together for one purpose, which was to keep everybody alive, you would get married, remarried pretty quickly in a position where a husband lost a wife, which again happened very frequently. Nursing homes and also poor houses. So we have all of these public functions that the colonial families did. So next slide. And so we had what we would call a familial mode of production. So it was production, reproduction, and consumption. Production being actually growing the carrots and, you know, weaving the wool and that sort of thing. Reproduction, having kids, and consumption, actually consuming what you made. And when it comes to reproduction, in an economic mode of production with the family, in farms, many hands make light work, right? You've ever heard that. With farms, you had a lot of people, a lot of things to do, and so a lot of hands became economic assets on the farm. So that's one of the reasons why we had so much reproduction and high fertility rates in the United States at that time, because we needed them. So next. There was really no room for privacies or private lives. You had one common room. And it wasn't, people did, the idea, I still, even me, I have to laugh when I see these larger houses where the kids have their own bathroom, right? That just drives me, I just don't get that, because there's just so much privacy, right? Everybody has to have their own space. And you certainly know that, you know, I need my space. But there, you didn't have private lives. Everything was sort of in public view. And the things that you did were public business in terms of keeping everybody alive, or, you know, hey, go get the midwife, or all of these other things. So we have this idea of a public family that kept everybody alive and did the economic work and took care of people and did participate in the life of the community. And so that's that one term, public, I just want you to kind of keep in mind, because that's one part of a family when you think about the definition, is the public family. Go ahead. They produce children, they care for the young, poor, and elderly, and critically, nowadays, by performing these tasks, they're saving public monies, right? We know for sure that if we had to buy in the marketplace all of the caregiving that's done by daughters and mothers in particular of older people, it would cost trillions of dollars, and all of the cost of the care that we provide as family members to our loved ones who need it. So this is a public good that we're doing. We're trying to keep everybody alive. We're trying to help everybody. And so it saves our society and our federal government and our local government a lot of money to do that. But it's the economic aspect to it that we're keeping, you know, if we had to pay for everybody to, you know, all the food for everybody and all of those other things, again, that would be a huge cost. So the family is really taking on an economic aspect of keeping people alive. And so that economic component of families is that public part of the family that we really rely on it for. So go ahead. Then things changed, right? We become an industrialized nation, and we change the way that our economy works. So instead of a family farm where men and women in particular are working together in tandem, everybody has their own thing to do, but they are respected for the fact of what they do. You have this separation into men and women's spheres. And this is when we're going from familial to labor. The mode of production goes from not I'm growing my carrots, it's to I'm working for a wage, I get money, and then I buy the carrots. So I have changed to a commercial capitalism. And this is where men now work outside the home to get those wages, and then women are staying inside. So the world of work is governed by this business ethic, and the world outside the home, I could talk a whole semester on just sort of the history of women and how that separate spheres came about really is because of the Industrial Revolution and taking husbands out of the home. And so you see the family now becomes like this, the term that a famous historian uses is a haven in a heartless world. It's this idea that we have this horrible capitalism and horrible industrialization. It's dirty, it's smelly, it's all of these other things. And so then the home becomes this place of respite and a place to be calm. And if you look at this, you know, about mid-1800s, now that you know, you'll see it. But in homes of that time, you start seeing even stained glass in those houses because they're becoming church-like. They're becoming calming. They're becoming this place of tranquility. I'll just leave it at that. All right, next. So what that did is it changed marriage. Right, you went from this idea of these two separate but sort of cooperative groups of people, and even like back then in the colonial era, you would hear, like, you don't really hear this very much anymore, but you hear fishermen, but you've heard fishwife, right? You've heard that term, like when you might maybe read older stuff, like women would actually have those roles as well. But then you start coming into this marriage goes from this economic support system to the emotional satisfaction and companionship of this loving relationship. And men and women also become more economically independent because you have separated out what they need to do. You don't have to have both of them there, sort of this wages. Well, I have wages, so maybe I like this person better, so I'm gonna give the wages to her and have a family with them. So there's a lot less interdisciplinarity or interdependency. And so you see this marriage bonds being weakened and divorce becomes more common. This is, we're talking about like 1900s or so. And you can see certainly the divorce rate just goes up and up and up in the United States until about 1960. Then it sort of gets a little bit higher and then sort of levels off in 1980s, and we haven't really gone up anymore. And the reason for that is more people aren't getting married, so they're not getting divorced, right? You gotta be married to be divorced. And that's actually something hard for family scholars to study, because we can study people who are married and people who are divorced because we have a record of that, right? We have a legal record, but if you're living with somebody, how do we know? Like, how do you study? So this is a big challenge, actually, for family scientists, is to figure out how do we capture that. Particularly because if you look at the economic aspect of the family, it's kind of easy to see. But when you get to the emotional aspect of the family, what does that mean? And who is doing this? Who is taking care of us emotionally? Why is it so important? You didn't really worry about loving your spouse in the, you know, colonial era, or even in sort of the mid-1800s. You looked for a good match. Somebody who could take care of you, either economically or like raise your children and be part of the family. But again, if you look in Victorian homes, men and women would have separate bedrooms. And we had what was called a homosocial world, where men hung out with men and women hung out with women. And you don't really see this, this idea of this husbands and wives taking care of each other emotionally until the 1900s, until this time where the basis of marriage is moving from an economic to more of an emotional and companionship idea. So marriage becomes about love, all right? And again, there's a great book by Stephanie Coons, who's an American family historian, and it's called Marriage, A History, and the subtitle is like How Love Conquered Marriage. Because this idea of actually loving the person that you're married to wasn't really a concept until about the 1920s. I tell my students, you know, this idea of finding the one person out there, that there's a soulmate for you, and there's the one, and if you can just find the one, then everybody will be, you know, life will be perfect. And that's just a bunch of crap. That's truly what it is, right? It just really comes from the 1920s. When you have this situation, we go from 1800, we have seven children per woman, and then in 1900, you're down to 3.5, so you've gone half. The fertility rate goes in half. Because number one, you were keeping kids alive longer, but also, now that we're moving to the cities and away from the farms, kids are an economic liability, not an economic asset. Rather than becoming many hands, make light work on the farm, now you have just another mouth to feed in the tenements. Right? And also, because they're living longer and we're living longer, that's another aspect of it, you can have fewer number of children because you don't have to worry about having eight and four will live to adulthood and take over the farm. You don't have to have that now. So you just have two or three, and you emotionally invest in them. All right? So you can emotionally invest in them, your child rearing rather than child bearing. All right? Women were doing a lot of child bearing, and then they move into more child rearing. And at the same time, because you're living longer, and these people and your kids are growing up and growing out of the house, and you actually might still be with the same person that you married a while ago, right? Then you're like, oh, well, maybe I should talk to this person, or, you know, like them, or just kind of get to know them. And the actual term in the 1920s, we call it the companionate marriage. We move to the time when husbands and wives are supposed to be enjoying each other's company. With the flappers in the 1920s, women are allowed to be sexual beings, and you're supposed to enjoy sex. You're supposed to enjoy sex with your spouse. That's a big one. Because in the Victorian era, the men, there's huge amounts of sexually transmitted diseases, because men would see prostitutes a lot in the Victorian era, because their wives were pure angels and taking care of their families, and so they shouldn't be sullied by sex But then in the 1920s, we change, and it's okay for husbands and wives to enjoy having sex together. And again, you also see a change in the houses. If you look particularly, the companionate marriage has its height in the 1950s, which goes back to our, you know, our ideal, a supposedly ideal family. If you look at that house, women don't have their own spaces, right? You remember Virginia Woolf is writing A Room of One's Own in like the 1920s, right? It's this idea that women are supposed to be able to have their own space, because you start seeing women losing their own space physically. Like, there's no place in a 50s ranch house that a woman can be alone in a very different way than in the Victorian era. So you have these children, and you're investing emotionally in them, and that becomes another reason why we have to have these families where not only do we love our husbands and our wives, but we love our kids, versus this kid is just going to help me raise the farm. So next. All right, so therefore, with this change in the family and this emotional investment, we go to the other concept of the family, which is the private family. All right, this is the things about the intimacy, emotional support, love. Next. Children first form their attachments. Yeah, sorry. And teenagers take steps, and adults share their inner lives with someone else, right? That was a big thing that you want to share. I will say that, again, you didn't really share your feelings in the Victorian era. One of my mentors, when I was in graduate school, he decided he was going to read some Victorian diaries and see what he found. And he ended up writing a book on grief. That's what he ended up writing about, because that's where people shared their grief, was in their diaries, not necessarily with other people. Now we have to talk to everybody all the time. And I also talk to my students about the unrealistic expectations of marriage. And one of the unrealistic expectations is to have that person be the one and to take on all of your emotional stuff in addition to their emotional stuff, and the two of you all will be, you know, as one. I really dislike when this idea of you complete me, like I'm one half and you're a half, and we're going to become a whole. That really, really puts a lot of stress on your partner, right? It really does. And in a lot of ways, it's not fair. So we talk about making sure that you have friends outside the marriage, and, you know, having your own things, because then it's a choice that you're coming together rather than this person has to be everything, because they're always going to fall, right? They can never live up to that unrealistic expectation. And I have to say that at UMKC, we have a lot of students who are not traditionally aged, or even if they are, they can be coming married, et cetera. So I tell this in any class that I have the opportunity to talk about this. And after class, one of the women said, she wrote this down, like, I was married, and I am married, and because of this lecture, we're doing more things separately. Like, I'm hanging out with my friends more, and he's hanging out with his friends more, and things are going better, right? Because this idea of getting away from the ideal, which can never be reached, how can we move ahead with making sure that everybody does get their needs met? All right, next. So then as we moved along in families, in the history, there's two other fundamental shifts that changes the way that we think about how people live their lives. One, women, and in particular wives and mothers, enter the labor market and they stay there. And then the other thing is that people live longer. If there's anything that you would like to get out of a family demography talk, that's it. Is that since World War II, women have been in the labor market and they stay in the labor market. Currently, the fastest growing group of women in the labor market are women with mothers with children under the age of one. Okay. So think about that. So it's the fastest growing group. And the reason that it's the fastest growing group is because that was the group of women who stayed out of the labor market, right? Before, in the 1950s, you might have, oh, my kids are out of school, so then maybe I can go back, and you start seeing from the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, et cetera, you start seeing, well, first, wives can keep their jobs, and then mothers that help older kids can get a job, or then mothers who have elementary school age kids can have a job, and then, well, then mothers who have young children can get a job, they have daycare and those sorts of things. And now, because of the economic necessity of having to have at least one, and you know, two if you can, people in the labor market, so that last stalwart sort of holdout group of women were women with kids under the age of one, and now they're not leaving the labor market either, okay, because they really just can't afford to. And then, so there's that part of it, which gave women the opportunity to be economically independent. That's one of the reasons why divorce has gone up as well, because you're moving away from that public interdependence. And so now women don't need to stay in a marriage if they're if they're threatened or they're abused or those sorts of things. I'm sure you've had a lot of, I just saw some Mosca information in the bathroom, it's awesome, but a lot of people ask, you know, well, why does she stay? And it's usually for economic reasons. I can't get a house, I can't, you know, afford this, that, or the other thing, so I'm going to stay in this abusive relationship that doesn't meet my private family needs because it does meet my public family needs of, you know, putting food on the table and taking care of the kids. And then the other is that people live longer. In, again, 1900, average age expectancy was 48, and then in 2000s, you know, you're up to mid to late 70s, depending on if you're a man or woman, it's going up. And so when we think about this till death do us part, you have to remember that till death do us part was created when people died at like age 30. Right? So I was like, oh, okay, I'm gonna have to live my whole life for the rest of this person. It's just kind of this idea of what we think of ideal versus the reality really has to do with families are different now in that people live a really long time. And you can see, in terms of rates of divorce, there's a huge shoot up at 2 years. That's kind of like the peak when like, oh my gosh, I really don't think this person's the right one for me. And so, and then as you go and there's another like sort of blip at 7 years, right? You all saw the movie 7 Year Itch. Seems to be something about that. And then there's some 14 years and then it sort of goes down and down. So it's that 2 year part that really makes people think, wow, do I really want to stay with this person? And am I old enough? We do know for sure that if you are, remember I said, two halves don't necessarily make a whole. It's two wholes come together and make something even better. Human development research bears that out. If people have a good idea of their own identity before they get into a relationship, then that relationship is healthier because, again, you're not asking that person to help you figure out your identity. And oh, this is the other thing. To the point with this two-year thing, there is one of the states in Mexico has, in Mexico, think about it, Catholic country, not a lot of divorce happening. There's a southern state in Mexico that has so many divorces at the two-year mark that one of the suggestions in the legislature, it didn't get passed, but one of the suggestions was that if you get married, it dissolves automatically at 2 years. Unless you want to continue it, then you actually have to take the steps to continue the relationship because literally they were just drowning in paperwork of people wanting to get divorced. All right, so we're not the only ones. And I just think that's partly, I think it's because it's Mexico. So you think of the sort of that historical traditional Catholic. But people are like, I don't have to stay in this marriage. And it's not gonna be like, it's not like he's sick and coughing now and he'll be dead in 2 years because he's been working really hard in the fields, right? He might be around for a really long time. So maybe we'll just cut our losses and move on. All right, next. So the other thing is that individualism has increased. And so people wanna get married, but they don't necessarily have to. Andrew Cherlin, who writes the textbook that I use called The Public and Private Families. He's the guy who comes up with this idea of the two different definitions that I really appreciate. He mentions in the 1950s, marriage was the entrance to adulthood, right? To be an adult, you got married, and then you got the house and the kids and the job. And certainly in the corporate America, you had to be married to get up the ladder, etc. Nowadays, because we've separated sex and reproduction, because we've separated childbearing and marriage, marriage is kind of like the cherry on top. Marriage is sort of that's the sort of extra thing. I can have a family, I can have kids, I can have a relationship, but actually getting married is more of this display of I really have made it versus the entry into adulthood. Because we don't feel like we have to marry. That's why you go back to, let's just go back to our, family with the white picket fence, because that's easy to think about, but that's not how people live their lives. And then marriage may compete with staying in school, developing a career, cohabiting, having a child outside of marriage. I like to tell my students, we all know the Susie and Johnny sitting in a tree, K-I-S-S-I-N-G, first comes love, then comes marriage, then comes baby in a baby carriage. And that's just not the way it goes anymore, right? You could have the baby and then the love and then the marriage, or baby and love or no love, or somebody else, you love somebody else. So you have a lot of situations where you have children being raised in households that don't necessarily have their two biological parents. It doesn't necessarily have to be a bad thing. We have trouble with that, but we know that if you think about the public part of it, we need to make sure that those kids are taken care of. And the private part of it, it doesn't have to be that you're related by blood to have somebody take care of your needs. And it certainly doesn't have to be through a heterosexual relationship or anything like that. We're being much more open about how if you think back to the function of this emotional support, let's be more open to allow everybody to have their emotional needs met in the best way possible. So next. And therefore, this is this modernity perspective, which I like, is that individuals have to make choices now about everything they do. It's not just, I'm going to get married and then have kids. It's like, am I going to have kids? Am I going to get married? Who am I going to marry? Who am I going to sleep with? And what gender am I more attracted to? So there's a lot of choices now that we've become much more individualized in our choices, which makes it freeing, and this is very much an American thing, very freeing to be able to be individualistic, but it does sort of leave us a little bit lost in terms of the way forward. So next stage, next one. All right, so I was trying to think, what might people be interested in? So for the purposes of policy, right, now that we don't have a lot of constriction on who you can spend your time with, et cetera, we wanna always be asking, when it comes to policy, which side of the family, the public family or the private family, is this particular policy impacting? Okay, so, and I'll just read it here. It says two key questions about public responsibility and private pleasures of a family. One, how well is any family taking care of children, the frail, elderly, and the ill? Or two, how well are families providing emotional satisfaction that people value? So you can see that when we talk about Head Start or WIC, then you're looking at the first question, the public family, and Medicaid and those kinds of things. And then number two, with the families providing emotional satisfaction, then you start seeing things about avenues to get out of domestic violence situations, or making sure that kids aren't being abused in their home and those sorts of things. So I love the idea of being able to sort of look at the coin and have two sides. It kind of gives us a more of a variety to think about what exactly do we want from this family at this point in time. All right, next. Okay, so because we have a lot more variety, one thing just happened last week or 2 weeks ago, and I want to show you a video of it. You might have heard about this video, this image that went viral. And so we'll watch this video from CBS News, and then we can add that to the questions.
Involves a bride, two men competing for her love, and a turn no one saw coming on the road.
For most of her life, 21-year-old Brittany Peck of Elyria, Ohio, felt caught in the middle, torn between two men she truly adored, her father, Todd Bachman, and her stepdad, Todd Sandrosky.
I felt like maybe I need to just, like...
pick?
Yeah, basically. Yeah.
What a position to be in.
I know. It was really, really tough. I was in kindergarten.
This all began back when Brittany was six. Her parents split up, then got wrapped up in a bitter custody battle.
It was riddled with lawyers and courtrooms.
Her dad, a short-haul truck driver, wanted custody and certainly had no interest in sharing his daughter with Brittany's new stepdad, who says the ill feelings were mutual.
We did not get along. We tolerated each other. That's probably the best way to describe it.
Over the years, things did improve slightly. They shared custody, and both men came to realize they were both pretty good fathers. But there was still a little tension in the air when last month the two families got together for Brittany's wedding. Her biological father was supposed to walk her down the aisle when all of a sudden he bolted to the front.
I said, I'll be back. And that's when I walked down the aisle, grabbed Todd, and said, come on.
He said, you had just as much of a part of this in raising these kids as I did. He goes, you're going to come and help me walk our daughter down the aisle.
Our daughter. He said, our daughter.
And that's when I lost it.
Hand in hand, they went back to get Brittany. Then arm in arm, they gave their daughter the wedding she always dreamed of.
It meant the world to me. It was the happiest moment of my life walking down the aisle with both of them.
In the presence of God and...
Parents and step-parents are often at odds, but the wisest eventually realize that getting along isn't just best for the kids. It's best for them.
If that individual accepts your children and treats them as his own, how can you not have respect for somebody like that?
He invited me to be part of that day. And that's something that can never be taken away. It'll always be there.
A little wedding day advice from the fathers of the bride. Steve Hartman, on the road in Elyria, Ohio.
Great, thanks. So you can see that they're making choices and they're figuring it out, right? We might not have a roadmap, but we do have the desire to make sure that both, you know, public and family, public and private sides of families are taken care of. And this is just a great opportunity to see that it's difficult, but people are figuring it out. Thank you.
We're taking a short break. You're listening to the All Souls Forum here on KKFI. We're listening to Deborah Smith talk about changing American families. And we owe you a few messages, and we'll be right back with the second portion of our show tonight. You're listening to the All Souls Forum here on KKFI.
Supporting 90.1 FM, Mixed Master Recording, for your next voiceover project, demo, or full album. Pro Tools certified and eager to bring out the full potential of your music. Mixnaster's passion is in the music, keeping the creative process in the hands of the composer. Information and scheduling at mixnaster.com. That's MIXNASTER.com.
This week on American Roots, Robert Randolph gathers his musical mentors, including slide brother Calvin Cook. Then a conversation with jazz adventurist Yusef Lateef about composing beyond the blues. Plus music from Lena Horne, Jack White, and Aaron Neville. I'm Nick Spitzer. Join me for American Roots from PRX.
Wednesday evening from 7 to 9.
This week on the Heartland Labor Forum, we talked to labor radio producer Rick Smith about his new book, Daddy, What's the Middle Class? It's about a cross-country trip with kids to find out who built America. Then we take a trip with a worker into the Amazon, the company, not the jungle, to find out if the jobs are sustainable. All that Thursday, 6 p.m., rebroadcast Friday, 5 a.m.
Hello, friends.
Tune in on Thursday night at 7 p.m. for the Shots in the Night Halloween special. Don't miss it.
This week on The Bioneers.
We're a part of this movement that 24 hours a day in every nook, cranny, and watershed across this planet is waking up and taking action to care for people in place, under trees and on porches and in houses and in churches.
Two visionary citizen restorationists join us this week for Ripples of Community Resilience on The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature.
Friday morning at 9:30, right before Eclectics. The History of Witches on a special Halloween edition of Wings, Saturday afternoon at 2:30.
This retired federal employee, Bill Claw, is encouraging all my federal employee friends to please consider supporting KKFI during this year's combined federal campaign. That's CFC code 21994. Just a few dollars a week on payroll deductions won't mean much to you, but it'll mean big bucks to us at KKFI. So please consider supporting KKFI. That's agency code 21994.
This Halloween night, enter the macabre. A world where your favorite Halloween films become a reality. Experience the Diva Plava Laguna from The Fifth Element. Chant with the drums of the Kali Ma from the Temple of Doom. Featuring Casey's Dynamic Urban Orchestra. My Brothers and Sisters. Along with Jessica Page and other musical guests. At Knucklehead's Garage. Benefiting KKFI and the Midwest Music Foundation. Macabre. Come, we'll be waiting. Tickets on sale at macabrekc.com.
This Halloween, as part of KKFI's Halloween Night Extravaganza, tune into a very special episode of The Pipeline from 1 to 4 a.m. Join your host Colin Doyle as we creep through an ominous landscape of monsters, mummies, and gories on a dark and stormy night that you won't want to miss. That's the second annual Samhain Spooktacular on The Pipeline from 1 to 4 a.m. right after the live broadcast of Macabre KC. It's all part of the Halloween Night Extravaganza right here on 90.1 FM KKFI. Be there or else.
In the fairly recent past, there have been a number of incidences in the United States where young men have been involved in multiple shootings. And when you look at these young men's lives, it seems that there are at least two things that all of them have in common. First of all, they have no social skills, and second, they're very alienated from people in general, especially their peer group. So what would you say that the study of families in the fairly recent past can tell us about how we are managing to not meet these young men's needs?
Certainly, it's a good question. If you look at the multiple shootings, they're usually middle class, okay? And they're white men, usually. And when this actually happened, and there was two yesterday, I think, or Friday, there were two on college campuses. But the one that happened in Oregon, one of my other faculty is teaching a sociology of gender, and so I sent something to them where the person who was talking about it is that one of the big issues is a skewed sense of masculinity. What does it mean to be a man? What does it mean to be a strong man? And so they're warping this idea of being a strong man as being someone who has guns, right? And so you can see with this other family that they figured out that it doesn't have to be, we have to fight over this daughter's, everybody can be part of this daughter's lives as well. And then I'm a Girl Scout leader, and they're trying to include more men in the, and so that you can buy a t-shirt that says man enough to be a Girl Scout, which I like. So this idea of increasing the diversity of what we consider to be masculine and what we consider to be a good man. And I think that as you see more diversity in sexual orientation, in families, all of those other things, as we get to see more of that, or talking about that, then I think we'll hopefully, you know, sort of work a little bit better. Again, sort of, I'm not even going to go there with the gun thing, because that's just a tool by which people are sort of showing off their masculinity to the point where other people's lives are devastated.
Thank you. I found your description, warping and woofing on the public and the private, very, very helpful to some of my thinking. I spend a lot of time paying attention to what's happening with digital immersion, the transition from automation to everybody speaking on their thumbs all the time. What might be the sense in your professional perspective as to whether or not this change in boundaries and identities and exchange of information fits into either the public or the private, or perhaps there's some evil fusion going on, not to put too fine a point on it.
I think when we discuss technology and it comes with families and relationships, we tend to go with, it's bad, it's all bad. But let's think about the good things first. One is that my both sets of grandparents for my kids who live here, they're both on the East Coast. And my kid FaceTimes my mom a lot, right? And so they actually, my parents have a closer relationship with their grandparents than I ever had with mine. And I remember, okay, so I know you all remember waiting till 11 o'clock at night so the phone rates would go down so you could make a long distance call, remember? Like, that's just not even an idea now. So because we have fewer number of kids and people are living longer, they're living healthier, they're wealthier, a lot of that allows to have more of a multi-generational interaction. So that's actually a good thing in terms of technology and keeping more people connected. You know, it goes into personalities and personal relationships. I think in terms of families, one of my mentors wrote a book called The Intentional Family, is that you have to like make a choice. All right, we're going to make a choice to put down the phones and have a dinner. We're going to make a choice to spend time. And again, it goes back to that choice. We all have so many choices. There's a TEDx talk that one of the faculty members at Swarthmore says he's been teaching for 30 years, but he actually gives the kids less homework now than he did 30 years ago because those kids have more choices to make. Before, it was just you kind of knew what you were doing, but now we have so many choices. And for me, the technology is like, well, who's benefiting from the technology, right? And if it's not beneficial to families, then it's families need to make a decision about that, certainly parents and, you know, mentors. I don't think that anybody here, I tend to tell kids in like the stores and stuff what to do because I'm a teacher and I'm used to doing that. But it's kind of like it takes a village to raise a child. And if some families don't have that capacity, then we can always be helpful as well. So we're, you know, saying I'm not going to text you, let's go meet for coffee or those kinds of things. So just again, making an intentional idea. I think we're not ever going to get away from that, the technology, and in so many ways, the internet, Twitter, all of these things, we know so many things have become public that we wouldn't have otherwise known in the United States, in the world. You know, Arab Spring had a lot to do with Twitter, those kinds of things, that it's here and it can be used for good. We just have to make an intentional purpose to make sure that it's only used for good.
As you look at these broad trends overall through history, do you see significant variation when you look at class differences?
That could be a whole nother class. Actually, one of my, when I was getting ready for the talk, I was like, oh, wow, I really can't talk about class too much because the public-private family sort of goes across all. There's a very important book called Unequal Childhood by LaRoe, can't remember her first name right now, but she's looking at the difference between working class families and middle class families in the United States. She did her work in Philadelphia and Boston. Baltimore. Interestingly, she did not find any racial differences between black and white families. The differences in how they chose to raise their kids were purely class-based. And she has two different terms, which is awesome. One is called natural growth for working class families, and the other is called concerted cultivation. Concerted cultivation. So for the middle class families, you have the kids in the piano lessons because we know that that's good for their brain. You know, they're the ones that are always scheduled. You start seeing there's a great thing where they juxtapose going to the doctor and how while the parent is taking the kid to the doctor, the middle class parent is saying, you can talk to the, you know, ask the doctor about this weird thing on your knee. You have the right to ask him about this. And, you know, sort of being very cultivating a person who's very sure of himself and who's really out there and saying, I need my needs met, versus the working class family where they see authority as problematic and not answering the doctor necessarily when the doctor is asking, when the mom and the kid are in the exam room and the doctor says, so is this kid eating any, at least even yellow vegetables? Like, you know, yellow, not even green? And the mom's like, yeah. And then the researcher who's doing the observation writes a side note, I've never seen this kid eat a vegetable ever. Right? And so it's this idea of how are you going to be in the world? Are you going to sort of take it by storm, or are you going to try to stay out of trouble? And if you want to think the idea that our institutions are really middle class institutions, then you can start seeing how that inequality of even how the value system of how to be in the world is continuing to create and exacerbate this inequality. Does that help? I mean, it's a great book. It's really well written, Annette Leroux. It's called Unequal Childhoods. And it's a great way of seeing the differences in class differences. And I think it's critical that there are certainly are racial differences between black and white American families. But again, more and more you're seeing the bifurcation between class rather than race. Yeah.
We're going to have this be the last question, and it's going to have to be fairly brief.
As a social worker who trained academically in the 1960s and who's been retired for almost 20 years now, I appreciate your coming and updating. Of course, almost most of us are aware of many of the points that you brought up, but to see them tied together so nicely and made more logical is very helpful. Mm-hmm. But I'm wondering if, I don't think you mentioned this, but I wonder if scholars today are interested in what has been happening and what is happening with the differences in pace between the changes that women are going through and the changes that men are going through, and for that matter, the changes that children are going through, because the kinds of things that you talked about don't happen all at once with just the husband and the wife, or the man and the woman, or the two, the gay couple. They don't move at exactly the same pace in these things, and I think that makes a difference. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Are you talking about the individuals, the different pace of the individuals, or just the different paces of like gender changes or something?
Well, I think it could be in terms of society, it could be society or culture-wide changes.
Okay.
But also within family units, there could be some striking differences between the way men and women react to a lot of the same circumstances that come up.
Well, we certainly, you see since the 1960s, women, the second wave of women's movement, where women are saying we should not be shut out of the public sphere, right? Remember I talked about the private and the men and women separate spheres. So, I mean, women didn't even have vote in the United States till 1920, because the idea was that men were the public face of the family and they can make good decisions, right? Well, we know that that's not necessarily true. And so in the 1960s, you say, see women saying, I want to be in the labor market. I want to, you know, be part of the public life of the United States. And you see that, and the idea was that, well, then men are going to become, you know, women. So if men do this and women are down here, then the idea is not women are going to go up here, but men are going to come down here, right? Do more childcare, that kind of stuff. It didn't really happen, right? So you have this unequal revolution where that one of the researchers calls it the stalled revolution, where women are taking on men's roles, but men aren't taking on women's roles as quickly. I will say two quick things about that. One is that, therefore, you see a lot of the things that we expected men to do while women were working, men aren't cooking, we're going to buy food in the labor, in the marketplace. We're buying, maids are coming to our houses, we're buying these services rather than having men take them on. And then the other aspect of it is I think that this group of students that I'm seeing now, the students in the 19 to 25 year olds, I think they have a fundamental, like they have a shift, like they're okay with it. And right now in a third of husband and wife couples, which is not certainly the majority of the United States, but women make more than men. The woman in that relationship makes more than the man in that relationship. And so men are staying home because that's a rational thing. So there is change, I think, but it's going to always be an issue. And I think the thing to keep in mind is that now the marketplace is what's filling a lot of what we consider to be sort of, you know, the private stuff. We have people in our houses now cooking and cleaning. Thanks.
You've been listening to Professor Deborah Smith from UMKC's Family Studies program, talking about the history and the changes in American families. This program was recorded on Sunday, October 11th at the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church at 4501 Walnut Street in Kansas City, Missouri. This program is produced and edited for broadcast each week by Barry Lee. Thank you to Rita Norton and the staff at All Souls who provide us the raw materials for this show each week. You can find it on podcast if you didn't hear the whole show or you've missed some of the other shows. They are up within a week or two in podcast form on KKFI's website at www.kkfi.org. The theme music you hear in the introduction and in the outro of the shows each week is composed and played and recorded by Kansas City musician Fred Potter. Thanks again for attending the lecture this week. We'll see you again next Wednesday, same time, same place, right here on KKFI. You've been listening to the All Souls Forum. And you're also listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.